Since this podcast was recorded, Health Innovation Networks has become the new name for the academic health science networks you'll hear mentioned in the discussion.
We've all learned a lot since the coronavirus pandemic.
Rather than sit at a desk and tell the community what they need, and I think that made the difference because now people felt part of it, part of the research from beginning to end.
New ways of working involving digital technology are now commonplace. COVID-19 also highlighted the need for more equal care for all.
We've seen disproportionate deaths from COVID-19 between those living in deprived areas and those in least deprived areas. But we've also seen staggering ethnic inequalities across the healthcare in the pandemic in the NHS.
Innovation during a crisis is hugely important, but so too is taking time to evaluate new models of care to make sure future services are set up in the best way for everyone, including the health and care teams that provide them.
And I think when you talk to healthcare innovators and managers in these services, the struggles they have are not about money, they're not about technology, it's actually about cultural acceptance.
The NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, or NIP for short, is funded by NHS England's Accelerated Access Collaborative and jointly run by the Applied Research Collaborations and the AHSN Network. This rapid evaluation programme has been set up specially to look at 14 different innovation projects to see how best to take them forward post-pandemic.
There were kind of multiple steps to what we did. And first of all, we actually took a step back and we wanted to make sure that we were completely aware of what research evidence existed in this space of trying to improve targeted vaccination in underserved groups.
In this series of podcasts, we'll hear how health inequalities are being highlighted and tackled.
The more we listen to patients and carers, the better we get at doing things in a way that's acceptable and that not just hits the target, but meets the point as well.
And how the prioritisation programme is making a difference across England. There's lots to listen out for in this series of podcasts. I'm Nigel Thompson, and in this edition we'll be discussing how digital monitoring is making a difference and hearing the experiences of three guests. Dr. David Krill is a Director of Insight at Wessex AHSN. Dr. Jennifer Lynch is a Senior Research Fellow and Project Lead at the National Institute for Health and Care Research, the Applied Research Collaboration in the East of England. But first, Tracy Marriott, Director of Clinical Innovation Adoption at Oxford AHSN, sets out how the pandemic prompted changes to stroke services in her region.
Oxford AHSN developed guidance on managing the transient ischemic attack and minor stroke through virtual clinics. And this was based basically on early implementers of virtual TIA clinics and addressed how each stage of the clinical pathway, such as referral, initial triage and consultation, could be completed virtually, with hospital attendance therefore being limited to necessary investigations, such as the common brain scans that we would do for this sort of diagnostic, such as MRIs or carotid imaging, ECGs and blood tests. But post the pandemic, we noticed that some of the models of care were reverting back to pre-pandemic models of care, where patients came in on a more face-to-face basis. And we wondered why some services had chosen to retain the virtual model while others had reverted back. So as the services differ also across the Southeast, we were interested to understand what would be the minimum guidance that could be set up to manage different patient groups.
And you were saying before about people kind of reverting back to the way things were before the pandemic. What was the reason for that, do you think?
What we've subsequently found is that as we went through the programme, we interviewed patients and we interviewed clinicians as to what their preferences were and what were some of the barriers for working either virtually or on a face-to-face basis. The traditional model of patients is face-to-face, and some patients think they are getting a lesser service by being seen virtually and are willing to travel far distances and manage complicated personal arrangements to be seen in clinic. For some patients, some TIA patients, being seen is very important because it gives them reassurance and confidence. On the clinician side, many clinicians also realise that there are benefits for face-to-face because they can obviously, you know, physically see the patient. However, there are opportunities from other models of care where there's a mix of virtual and face-to-face to manage the resource situation.
In terms of numbers of patients, how many do you think we're talking about? Any ideas?
So across the country, we have about 46,000 patients who have TIAs or mini strokes every year, and about 500,000 patients live with TIAs, mini strokes. The probability of you having a full-blown stroke is about 20% higher if you experience a TIA, and usually that can happen within a few months of having a TIA. So receiving treatment rapidly is obviously really important. So I think the program that we're doing will contribute to understanding where is that optimum level of service, how do you deliver it in an optimal way so that you get a mixture of virtual and face-to-face. And the reason why we need to do that is because, of course, there are constraints on workforce and also, you know, some of the admin tasks or more routine consultation activities can be done virtually.
And as you said before, with the numbers of people who go on to have a full stroke, by taking this action now, I suppose you're kind of stopping those numbers, the sheer numbers increasing for the future, which will itself put pressure on the NHS and the care services. So it's kind of it's investing now for the future, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the thing to understand is that what we found from the study has been that there are limited resources in a day to see patients in that day, if you like. So if you have 8 TIAs happening or mini strokes happening in a day, bringing them into the hospital and seeing all of them during that period and getting them MRI scans, etc., it's really quite challenging. And so you need the clinician to be able to have access to the patient virtually, determine the severity and urgency, and then prioritise those patients. So that's where the virtual part comes in.
So in terms of how it's working so far, what are the signs at the moment?
Well, the signs are that in terms of where we've got to now since post-pandemic, services have gone back to more face-to-face activities. There's no doubt about it. Both patients and clinicians like to have face-to-face contact for obvious reasons. Patients feel more reassured, and so do clinicians, because they can actually see that patient and see if there's any, you know, phenotypical signs that might indicate that there's something to look at here in more depth. But what we've found since we've been through the pandemic experience is that actually, when you look at the processes that we use, there are actually opportunities to do some of these things virtually and to preserve some of the contact or more diagnostic activities such as the MRI scans and other activities such as blood tests and ECGs that obviously need to take place physically.
So I guess it's a balance, isn't it? We were saying later in the conversation with our colleagues that, you know, it's about making sure that the care is the right package of care, I guess, for the patient, but also bearing in mind the support they may or may not have where they live.
And that is a really key thing, Nigel. I absolutely agree with that for sure. Having carers around is a really important aspect of a lot of the models when we move towards this sort of virtual care. You know, someone suffering a mini stroke may be quite disabled from the episode, and how would they communicate in a virtual situation, one may ask. Well, you know, the reality is that if you have carers at home who can help you, you may well be able to manage that situation by having that conversation with the carer. But this is, I think it's really important to understand, particularly when we're talking about mini strokes and TIAs. When you see the symptoms, you may think that you're having a stroke, yeah, or that the patients are having a stroke. And in that instance, of course, if there's any doubt, there is the paramedic or whoever is looking after that patient will send them and admit them into hospital. It's where there is some difficulty with the diagnosis and they're not quite sure, is it a stroke or isn't it a stroke, that we would use this technology in a safe way.
Well, we'll probably talk about more this in more detail later. But Tracy, thanks for now. Thanks very much. Good insight into what's happening in one part of the country. Let's go somewhere else now. Perhaps talk about another issue that's concerning many, and that's the frailty of our ageing population. It's an area that Dr. David Krill has focused on for Wessex AHSN. David, what prompted you to look at this area in particular? And also, I wonder about the potential scale involved. Where do you start with a programme that is as wide-ranging as this?
The idea for this came from our integrated care systems, from the ICSs. At Wessex, both the AHSN and the ARC cover Hampshire, Isle of Wight, and Dorset. And there was a clear view that during the COVID pandemic, a lot of technology was quite literally thrown at the system and thrown at people. But there were some challenges. And I guess those challenges that were seen by the ICS, there are three of them. One is around demographics, one is around geography, and then the third one is around assumptions around uptake of digital technologies. So demographics, particularly Dorset, Isle of Wight, have a higher than average number of older people, older populations, and not all frail people are old, but a lot of older people have frailty. So that's an issue that has to be dealt with. In terms of geography, the distances and the connectivity to be able to get to treatment locations is difficult. So there's a benefit there for digital technologies. And then there were some assumptions around the benefits that come from using digital technologies. One of them, there's a popular perception that older people are not good with digital or avoid digital. There were some assumptions around the effectiveness, the efficiency, the savings that would come out of this. And there was also assumptions made around the intuitiveness of digital, that the word intuitive is used a lot by app developers, by digital technology developers, and just this assumption that everything is easy to use. And so the systems came to us and asked us to look at this. And it's not just the health side, but the local authorities as well, because they work on the social care side, and a lot of people with frailty have support packages coming from the local authorities. So it came from them. And to get a start on it, we wanted to focus on how people perceive this. So when a technology is offered, what do people think? So it's the patient themselves. What do they think of the technologies? The staff, the clinical staff, what do they think of it? And importantly for us, the carers, because a lot of people with frailty have carers who are family members usually. They're busy, they're doing other things. And a lot of the work of maintaining these systems or introducing them or just or interacting with a digital remote monitoring system falls on the carer. And so we wanted to ask them, what do they think of this? How does it affect your life? Does it help? Those kinds of things.
And what kind of reaction did you get? I can imagine many people were perhaps a bit suspicious, a bit reticent about taking on something that, as you said, as you hinted before, it could be seen as a way of, you know, making care or perhaps reducing the detail or the depth of care. Was there suspicion at the start?
Interestingly, that didn't seem to come out too much. The message that came from a lot of the patients, so talking to the groups of patients or individual interviews, was an openness to technology and understanding that this could be valuable and helpful. But there was a very clear message of there needs to be more support. So it's about providing more instructions, spending a little bit more time tailoring the introduction of a technology to that individual person so that they understand it in their own circumstances, and also then for the carer to understand how to work certain, you know, aspects of the technologies and how that could be managed. So that came from the carers and patients side. From the staff side, there was an issue there about perceived lack of reliability and false alarms. And that tends to impact on the trust of a digital remote monitoring technology. And so that led to the same ideas of wanting to have simple instructions for the staff to help them trust the system and understand how things were working. But by and large, it was positively received, although we did identify some interesting. So one of our kind of anecdotes, one of our stories from a person using this was a patient frailty also has dementia. Often people have multiple conditions. They were part of the trial. They have a system to monitor their movements into the kitchen. So it's just a box that sits on the kitchen table, and it just measures how often the person goes into the kitchen. And that kind of implies that they're still mobile and they're getting hydrated, and it sends a signal. And everything was fine. The patient was fine with it. The carer was fine with it. They left it in the kitchen. Everything seemed fine. After 2 hours, the signal stopped. The signal from the box stopped. So, okay, that's all right. The carer, who's a family member, came by the house later in the day and discovered that the patient had completely forgotten what this thing was, saw it cluttering up the kitchen table, and then put it into the drawer. And so, of course, the signal stopped working. And it is things like that that seem small, but they do affect how these technologies are used and how efficient they're going to be in helping the NHS monitor these patients.
I'm sure it's early days, yeah, but have you got any signs of what impact it's having on things like hospital admissions or a GP appointments, things like that? Is it having an impact already?
If we do know from this particular project, we weren't able to see that in this particular project because there was so much pressure, especially on the system. And so the numbers of people that picked it up wasn't as high as we saw. However, in a parallel project we have noticed that using this type of technology in the virtual wards, it did reduce the number of emergency callouts. That's the thing. So it does mean that that a lot of situations and issues can be resolved in the location, so in the home, or if it's in the care home, that can be dealt with as opposed to having to bring them into the hospital. So it does help when it works. It does seem to help.
And do you think this perhaps has been perhaps the first stage of a range of kind of rollouts, I suppose, getting people confident, building people's confidence, whether it's a carer, it's a patient, or a member of the NHS, the staff? Do you think this is a start of a longer-term plan to build confidence and also make sure the actual kit itself is robust and can cope with the variations of technology?
Well, yes, and that was one of our primary outputs, was to be able to identify these issues so that the systems can build it into the rollout and learn from it and make it more effective right from the beginning. So having appropriate training for staff to be taking that time and not making assumptions about older people. So offering digital technologies to pretty much everybody who is appropriate for it, giving the right instructions and having that support package around it so that the local authorities and the NHS can benefit from it. That was our primary goal, is to have that evidence so that we don't just think that digital is really easy and we can just throw it at people.
It's interesting some of the points you make about sort of the connectivity and people perhaps being confident to make use of it. It leads us nicely perhaps into our next discussion point, where it becomes apparent still that there's this issue of inequality. People who perhaps have access to Wi-Fi or live in an area where there is good 4 or even 5G connectivity, not all of us live in those areas. Certainly, perhaps this is an area that Dr. Jennifer Lynch may be able to help us with a bit more information and insight into how she's worked. Jennifer, you've worked as a senior research fellow in the east of England. You've looked at inequality as part of your programme. Just give us an insight into what area in particular and what have you found?
Thanks, Nigel. Yes, so we were interested in understanding what types of patients should be prioritised for remote monitoring pathways, or at least being able to identify what are the key characteristics of the patients who actually benefit from this kind of service. So as David was saying earlier, obviously during the COVID-19 pandemic, virtual wards and remote monitoring solutions were accelerated rapidly. But it happened when there were a number of different sort of barriers were kind of automatically removed, I suppose, because of the need to assist people in a different way. Because of this, I think relatively little is known about what sort of patients are really benefiting and what kind of information we need about patients to be able to understand who might potentially benefit, who's not currently benefiting.
And how do you go about finding out people? Because I suppose for some people, it's almost like it's seen as intrusion, as almost thing they don't want to admit to, that they don't have access to Wi-Fi, they don't have an email account, things like that. And people can be quite prickly, can't they, about sort of admitting that they're not tech savvy or not interested or suspicious. So how do you go about sort of making sure, or at least offering the chance for people to become involved in something like this and reduce the inequality that exists?
I mean, I think it is a really difficult one to tackle, and particularly for NHS systems to tackle, because it really relies on a particular understanding of the patients that they are dealing with and an understanding of the community that they are serving, and hopefully the development of integrated care systems will support that kind of work going forward. What we've found so far is that the kinds of data that you might require to be able to understand who these people are and where the particular inequities are in terms of access to the service, in terms of the types of difficulties and digital exclusion that people might be facing, that kind of data isn't really being routinely collected. So it's very difficult for sort of frontline clinical staff, I suppose, who are faced with responding to the patients that are in front of them, to be able to identify where those particular issues might be. So I think there is a real commitment within the NHS to really try and identify where these issues are, particularly in relation to rurality, access to digital technology, but also issues around sort of language. I mean, obviously, we know that there are potentially additional support that many people might require to be able to actively engage with digital technology. But being able to identify where those people are and how they might be able to respond better with the right kind of support is still a little bit of an unknown, I think, at a local level.
So do you think it's a case of waiting for a pilot scheme in a certain part, perhaps of your part of the world, and then word will spread that this is the way to do it? Is there a one-size-fits-all? I'm guessing when it comes to places, the region that you serve is vast, and the populations, as you say, the ethnicities of people involved there are very wide and varied. So I don't suppose there is a simple solution, as you've already hinted. It's going to be quite a hard way to achieve that. So what is your plan? How will you bridge the gap?
Yes. One of the things that we have done is put together a lived experience advisory panel as part of this work to try and bring in the views of patients and the public around how remote monitoring can be better targeted and how it can take into account, I suppose, the real sort of lived experience of people's lives and how they're coping with their particular conditions. So we've spoken to a number of people that raised issues around sort of, certain discriminatory practices around, for example, people who have cognitive impairment, how they're often automatically excluded from engaging with technology. So people with a diagnosis of dementia, for example, who may need a little extra support in order to be able to engage properly with this kind of technology. But just because they have a diagnosis of dementia doesn't mean that they should automatically be excluded. And our lived experience advisory panel also brought up the issue of the cost of living crisis and how that might have sort of negative impacts on people being able to manage their condition, whatever it is, at home. I mean, we were looking at a range of different conditions, such as respiratory diseases and asthma and post-surgery recovery and heart palpitations. And sometimes the home environment, although for the majority of people, this is the best place for them to be able to manage and where they feel most comfortable. If home is a potentially hostile environment for them in terms of being able to heat it properly, in terms of the general environment in which people are living, sometimes that's not the best place for them to be able to continue long-term care and having access to hospital and feeling that sense of safety within a hospital can be preferable. That isn't necessarily the sort of the general response of people, but I think it's something that needs to be taken into consideration when we're sort of constantly throwing this narrative out that it's always better for people to be at home and to be monitored from a distance.
I think one thing that occurs to me, having spoken to all three of you, is when it comes down to patients' conditions, it's choice, isn't it? Obviously, that's a driving force, but also perhaps it's what kind of support you have if you have a carer or a good neighbour or relations who will help you. I mean, can I ask you all, do you think that this program is mainly or perhaps driving your each areas into giving people priority, but also perhaps a bit more ownership of the kind of care that they need and deserve as perhaps never before?
Well, Nigel, from our perspective, the answer would be yes. I think you've described it quite well in that there's been a lot of choice. I think we're at that stage where we have perhaps too much choice. So a lot of options are being offered across the system, and each part of the country is offering different types of technologies to get to the same point, offering it to different people. So it's a lot of trial and error happening right now. And I think that will, you know, as we learn about the technologies and how people use them and how we as all of us as patients at any given point in our lives work with them and use them, then that will become a little bit narrower. And so then we'll have a more stable system where we have more trust in technologies as patients to use them. And so and that will help in several ways, because then there's a bit more consistency. It gets to the question of getting data that Jenny was getting towards. And ultimately, I think what we're trying to get to is helping people manage their conditions at a lower level of intensity. So everyone will get sick, everyone will something will happen to them at some point in their lives, but using digital to try and keep it at a low level so that it's manageable at home, for example, and it doesn't escalate into a very serious illness that then requires a hospitalization, for example.
Yeah, I think I would agree very much with that, David. And I think it's having an understanding that this is not a neutral issue for patients. You know, there are potentially additional responsibilities and burdens that come with managing conditions at home and engaging with technology. We had lots of examples of it being a really positive experience with the right support, and particularly when staff are supportive of that activity and feel that they are supported in being able to deliver those kinds of services. But it does require something more of patients in the way that they engage with both their own condition management, but also how they are able to engage with the technology itself and feeling confident and reassured that they are getting good care.
And final thoughts, I suppose, when it comes down to the future. Are you excited? Are you kind of a little more confident now, thanks to this program, the NIC program? Has it helped you perhaps escalate or speed up maybe the work you were planning or thinking of doing?
Excitement is an interesting word to use. I think we're a little bit more confident, perhaps, that we're that we have a better understanding of how technologies are being used and how they might pan out. And so that makes, hopefully, our outputs will allow for rollout of these technologies to be a bit more realistic and therefore have a greater chance of success. We're definitely moving towards it. I think it's more about trying to do it in a way that maximizes those chances of successful implementation as opposed to a haphazard throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks type of methodology, which is what happened during COVID because it was an emergency situation, clearly. But now we should be able to do that in a slightly more systematic way. And I think not just our project, but some of the other projects, the outputs that I've seen, Tracy's project is a good example of understanding how things should be planned out going into the future and to be more realistic.
How are you feeling now this program is kind of off the ground and working?
I would say that both confident and excited. I'm excited about the fact that we've really worked in a very collaborative way with the applied research collaboratives and the NHS to address a problem that is a practical problem. All of the programs that were selected were done because they had practical benefits for the NHS. Using the academic methodologies of doing evaluations and how you actually can leverage that in a practical way is really important because we're always looking at the benefits and considering the impact. There's been a lot of focus on health inequalities as an example, you know, so how do you actually get to patients and understand their perspectives, understand the cohorts of patients, the groups of patients that you actually want to interact with and who would be adversely affected by different service models or disadvantaged by different service models. We do know that we need to also collaborate more widely. So it's not just academia. We're working with third sector groups now, social services, care homes are obviously very important in this model. And there is a desire now to work more collectively rather than compartmentalize health, social care, academia.
Would you say that's one day, if there is such a thing, a benefit of what happened during the pandemic, that people were kind of forced to think differently, work a bit more in a different way, collaboratively and or more agile, perhaps? Is this what you think has happened?
Well, absolutely. I think needs must, wasn't it? I think certainly we had to work differently. And whilst technologies may have been there previously, they were not necessarily adopted to the same extent that we're now willing and open to doing so. You know, we've generally been more comfortable with, you know, having people come into hospitals or relied on a model where the workforce respond by having patients into their offices or into their clinical settings. The other thing that I think, Nigel, is that, you know, things have generally evolved, haven't they? You know, we do our banking online.
we have got more technologically savvy, so people are more comfortable and are becoming more comfortable with using technologies. The important thing is that there's somebody at the other end to respond. And if you know that they're there and you can provide them with the assurance that you can manage their conditions with them, people would be, a large group of people will be able to and can work with the NHS in that way.
I mean, I think a huge emphasis in the past on the actual functionality of technology and how shiny and pretty it is and how exciting the technology itself is. But actually what we know from our research is that it's the external factors often that affect how well they work in care. So it's how well the staff are engaged, it's how well the organization that commissioning those technologies are set up to innovate. It's an understanding of the work that's expected of patients and carers and families and supporters and the people around those people that are supposed to be using this technology. There are sort of political and policy factors that affect all of these technology implementation programs. So it's much wider than the technology itself, and I think we just need to be part of that conversation and banging that drum.
Dr. Jennifer Lynch, a senior research fellow and project lead at the National Institute for Health and Care Research, Applied Research Collaboration in the East of England. Thanks also to Tracy Marriott, the Director of Clinical Innovation Adoption for the Oxford AHSN, and Dr. David Krill, the Director of Insight at Wessex AHSN. If you'd like to learn more, go to the AHSN Network website and search for NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, or NIP for short. I'm Nigel Thompson. Thanks for listening.